I think we're about at a point where we can begin to get going. I know we will have a couple of more doing the trickle in effect, but we're the specific gravity is here, and we shouldn't penalize the timely by
the untimely.
I've got at least a tentative agenda which I've posted up, and some tentative goals. The second item on the agenda that I've got there is agenda review, so we can make some adjustments if people have topics they want to make sure to do. We have some goals here, which are, first of all, to advance a project that John and I and others here at Berkman are deeply involved in, so we're selfishly hoping we can do some of that, but also advancing digital institutional design more generally, and some network building as goals I have on the list. But the first thing I thought we'd do is go around and make sure that we know who everybody is. Richard Susskind is who we'll start with in a moment, but he's known, I think, pretty much everybody here. He is the excuse for us picking this date and this time. We could get him from the UK, and so he is our kind of convening focus. But beyond that, we're happy to have everybody indeed. Richard, why don't you start? If you don't mind.
A great pleasure to be here. How long are these introductions?
An hour.
On the briefer side.
On the second hour of this introduction. I am Richard Susskind. I spent most of my life thinking about technology and its impact on law, from working on AI and law in the 80s through to now spending about half of my time working with large law firms trying to think through the implications of emerging technologies for their practice. Spend quite a bit of time in computerization of the courts in England, and write books and give talks on, my latest book's called The End of Lawyers? But I'm putting out some fairly fundamental challenges to the way that law is administered and law is practiced. And it's a great pleasure to be here.
Have you just go ahead and talk to them?
I'm Brock Rutter. I've been a research assistant here at the Berkman Center to Professor Goodenough since November, in which time I've been eagerly reading several of your books, or at least two and a part of another of your books, and other stuff by various other people, including you two over there. And I'm very excited to be here today.
And we might mention your upcoming project that we for the state of Vermont, if you don't mind.
Oh, well, that's rather unglamorous compared to these laws.
It's maybe unglamorous, but it's actually doing it. So
I'm programming family law and possibly other poverty law relevant forms using A2J software, the stuff Ron Stout and people from the University of Chicago developed. I'm working for the state of Vermont when I'm not here, programming all those forms, and we'll see how many we get to. It's supposed to be at least the family law, and if we have more time, we'll do other ones.
Gene Koo, I'm a fellow here at the Berkman Center. I've been working a little bit with Oliver and John on thinking through Law Lab. Some time ago, I wrote a white paper on legal education and the changing legal practices because of technology. I'm still writing off of that, I guess.
You're taking there. Everybody. It's cloud law. You did that?
Hello, ceiling.
I think that's David Johnson.
Okay, try it again.
Are we Skyping?
Yes. I think it's David Johnson.
Try it again.
David, are you there?
Pebble in the pond.
Should be on.
It says we need Skype credit.
No, it's sent by SMS.
I'm paying the bill, huh?
It's been a hard year for Harvard, you know.
He's listed as online and there.
David, we just not have the speakers on.
He's making noises.
David, are we hearing you? Are you hearing us?
That's not gonna work.
There we go. Okay, great. We just needed to turn up our volume. David, we're doing introductions. Why don't you introduce yourself?
I teach New York Law School, and I think the relevant fact is We have a
Hackett's
Skype.
This is
Skype.
We're not there yet, right?
We're having our a little bit of a technology meltdown. David teaches law at New York Law School, where he is the head or one of the heads of their project on digitization in law, including a virtual companies project, which he has been deeply involved with, which is a portion of what we're talking about today. Is that okay, David?
Fine, thanks.
Great. Okay.
Can he hear us?
Yeah, I think you can hear us okay, right, David?
I'm sorry?
You can hear us okay. you can hear us okay?
Yes, I can.
Great.
Yes, I did.
Okay. I'm Edwina Rislin. I'm a professor of computer science at UMass Amherst. My interest is in case-based reasoning, AI in law, and related topics. For many years, I was a lecturer on law here, way back when, I suppose, and recently was a program director at National Science Foundation, and I'm interested to get caught up.
Hi, David. This is Ethan Katch. I'm also a professor. I'm a professor of legal studies at the University of Massachusetts. I had to come here to see Edwina. I haven't seen her in ages. Hi, Mark.
Morning.
My interests in the late 80s, early 90s correlated well with Richard. We published a book at the same time with the same publisher and covering some of the same themes. But about 10 years after that, I shifted most of my focus to the issue of online dispute resolution. I think actually, John, you were at the first meeting that David organized.
I haven't seen you for a long time. This is right.
But that's occupying most of my interest, and more specifically, our most recent project, our current project, involves electronic medical records and kinds of disputes that are likely to arise out of that initiative.
Hey, I'm Oliver Goodenough. I'm one of the co-directors, along with John, of the Law Lab project here at Berkman. We are have a broad set of goals ranging from some fairly basic research to the development of applications. We have a particular focus, thanks to our funding from the Kauffman Foundation, on the impact of digitization on the way the law supports innovation and entrepreneurship. And we are hoping, as I say, to both pick your brains in the course of the day on our own things, hear what you're up to, and start in on some network building. I should mention, by the way, that we are recording and we'll probably pod this in some fashion. Webcast, there we go. John's task. You'll hear, I don't come with a technical background, and part of John's job is to make me sound not too silly when I say things. But we will be webcasting, and your presence here and your participation constitutes your consent to such. Okay? How about that for a question?
Well done.
The shrink wrap approach.
Exactly.
John Clevenger, as Oliver said, I'm a co-director here. I've been a fellow for the Berkman Center for almost 5 years, and my interest here was in the area of identity, an open and user-centric identity. I did a project called Higgins, and particularly interested in how you develop trusted networks and scale trusted networks, and then how do you have the governing self-organizing networks. And that has led to a concept of promoting here of the notion of a cloud platform, cloud law, and building sort of a platform by which dispute resolution is one aspect, reputation systems as a web services link that you actually can create a governance module. We'll be talking about that. And in the context of what's being discussed here, I'm very interested in a use case to develop a very simple pilot around evolvable law. And my background is, this is a way back machine, because I haven't seen her in 30 years, must be. So so my background has been in natural language, and sort of returning that a bit and taking sort of a natural language models and coupling that with some genetic programming to see, can you really talk about evolving, say, operating agreements around different fitness functions to see whether one party gets captured to another, and then can you talk about robustness of agreements in that form? Because my notion is, as you start to, the opportunity, and I'm making all of them nervous when I say this, but that's why I like to say it, but it is that you have a million members and you have lots of people, then can you really have a new kind of algorithmic governance, not just purely algorithmic, but allows you to new kind of legal forms and new kind of governance mechanisms, employing reputation systems, and new kinds of collective action, I think, are possible. So this is part of the exploration.
I'm Mark Mahaly. I'm a colleague of Oliver's at Vermont Law School, where I run the environmental program. And tagging along as an observer, I spent 30 years in San Francisco founding and running an environmental law firm, where I had the pleasure of living through display writers, and every iteration of technology after that. I'm pretty tired from having spent the last 3 months convincing successfully my bureaucracy to move into distance learning.
Good.
I'm Caroline Nolan. I'm a research associate at the Berkman Center, and I work on a couple of different projects, but recently came on board Law Lab to do some project coordination and other things. So I'm very happy to be here.
I'm Sebastian Diaz. I come from the inverse, I guess, of you guys. I'm not a lawyer, I'm a technology person, I guess, that's working in law. But my primary responsibility is everything technological at Berkman. I am the chief geek.
Berkman proudly does indeed have its geek cave, and Sebastian is the alpha geek.
They have jousting every Thursday.
Richard was our leadoff.
Oh, cool. So I'm the last. I'm Mark Lawrenson. The best title I ever had was Chief Illegal Officer at AmeriCouncil.com, a startup during the .com era. I spent 15 years here as a clinical director and teacher and early legal technology researcher, and I presently run three companies, one called Capstone Practice Systems, which builds custom systems, or as Richard would say, bespoke systems for law firms, law departments like MetLife and Microsoft and firms like Davis Polk and Covington, but we also do a lot with legal services. Probably half of our time is building nonprofit systems. We put together this thing called National Public ADO, which stands for Automated Documents Online. It's a free national utility for legal aid advocates and low-income clients to generate documents using online intelligent forms. So that's what I'm most proud about at the moment. We're doing about 250,000 unique assemblies a year at this rate, but we think we need to get to about 1 million a month for it to really start being real. I'm very interested in modeling documents. That's what kind of I spun off on from being a clinical teacher into how do you automate and construct document models that can be intelligently assembled by interacting with users. And recently my obsession is with online deliberation systems. How do we build an online platform for deliberation about choices? And I talked to Gene Koo about that and some other people, but that's me.
Great. And we have one other arrival.
No, really.
We're just doing our introductions.
Okay. Good timing. Are we on Skype too?
We're on Skype. We're webcast.
Not webcast recording.
We're recording for later web.
Oh, right. For later.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Good morning. I'm John Palfrey. I work here at Harvard Law School and delighted to be part of the Law Lab crew. I spend part of my time here at the Berkman Center in part. Working on sort of information for the law school broadly, including the library. So how that relates to digital drafting, but trying to figure it out.
Great. Brock, at some point, if you didn't mind, just checking on the folks at Full Spectrum and also Peter Early to see whether they did get that stuff, that would be great. I apologize for that interruption. All right, we've gone around introductions, agenda review, and problem definition. In terms of agenda, I know that one of the things that we're hoping to do is be able to describe the project or two that we've got in process. I know that other people would like to do the same, and we'd indeed love to hear that. That would be what I viewed as the sort of second piece of this, is to share around some of what we're up to in more detail. There is this Law Lab use case, which I will distribute a bit a background on, which we are
are hoping to get some advice and guidance with out of this group, and also let you know what it is and see what your thoughts and also possibilities of participation might be. But we don't want to usurp that. I know other people will have other things that you will want to make sure we get into the discussion mix. More generalized use cases is my attempt to capture that on number five. We want to make sure that we have a little time to talk about the evolvable law aspect. And then I would always hope that we would talk about next steps. Are there pieces that people would want to make sure we captured going forward in your own agendas or needs? We can adjust as we go forward, obviously, but that's it. Again, as I said, the goals that at least I have identified would be to help us advance this virtual company project, advance digital institutional design more generally, some network building. Are there other goals that any of you would have, and you know, anything you would want to try and make sure we took away today? All right, there we go. The tyranny of stuff on the board has achieved its goal once again. Anyway, agenda review, problem definition. What is our problem? I mean, as we've been trying to think through the problem, we've been everybody at this table is here because I think you're at least partway into this definition as well, which is what does law look like? What does lawyering look like? What do institutions, the kind of things that law supports, look like as we migrate them more and more into a digitized world? What does that look like? And then what are some of the opportunities which that presents to us in that process? Would other folks define the problem a little differently? How would you see the statement of the case that we're working on here?
I think it's too early for me to. If you don't mind, I'd quite like to listen for a few minutes and then absorb, okay, and then come through, because I'm not entirely immersed in this yet.
Okay.
If I'm trying to just get a little clarity on sort of what we're looking at this, so is what we're doing right now an attempt to start to drill down on it?
Not yet. Well, that's number four is the law lab use case.
Okay,
I'd like to see where we see, as I say, I've put down my attempt at encapsulating kind of the thing we're all working around. And I'd love to hear other people's statements of that and kind of where you see, what are we working on here? You're in the midst of this. You're working on some projects, obviously. What's the statement of the case?
One agenda is kind of building a collaborative codification of current law for the sake of public access. That's an agenda. It's quite interesting and I think achievable in the current state of technology, mm-hmm. Of which I assume your use case is kind of a subset, a particular instance of an institution that would be constructed in virtual space.
Yes, yeah.
But for accomplishing real-world legal objectives.
Yeah,
could you clarify? I mean, I'm intrigued by the kind of things that you do for companies and say, and you know, where is the because I've been out of the field for a number of years, but where is the point of maturation? And you're saying building models of documents and that can, you know, there's a lot of range in what that is. What you really mean by it, and where what customers are looking for and how they're using it, I'd be really intrigued by that.
Well, that's a big topic, but in that particular space, I mean. There's a very mature set of commercial technologies now for doing the specific task of modeling complex legal documents. So everything from leases and indentures and merger agreements and licensing agreements. Almost every legal document lends itself to adequate modeling. And then once it's been modeled using one or more of these tools, you can present an interface to some consumer to make decisions and provide information, and then have the document be constructed perfectly based upon the model. And so that's well behind us. We've had those technologies for 15, 20 years now. They finally reached the marketplace. They're inexpensive. They're well understood. There are people who know how to do it. And so that's one of the things we do is we go to law firms or law departments and we take a particular practice and turn it into one of those interactive models. So that's available. That's kind of on the shelf for people who have aspirations to build some kind of online environment. You can tap into that expertise and componentry and construct systems to do it.
So I could assemble a shareholder's agreement.
Sure.
As simply, and for
I think so. Yes.
Investment.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's so a combination of your expertise and somebody's tool and somebody who knows how to use the tool, and it's I wouldn't say it's trivial, but it's mainstream common practice now.
I can have a go at what you're asking for now. My broad interest and observation is that a huge amount of legal work, both that goes on in law offices and the way that justice is administered by the courts and elsewhere, is very, very handcrafted. It's highly manual. It's highly inefficient. And my basic proposition is that some legal work can be automated altogether. Some legal work can actually be taken away from lawyers and given to paralegals or to legal executives, people who get some legal insight, and with the support of various systems and processes can quite reliably discharge legal work. And some legal work can actually be given directly to end users, to citizens or maybe people running small businesses. And why I think that all of this is so terribly important just now, because I think that Mark's observation is right, that for as long as we've known each other and longer, there's been technologies available for the automatic generation of documents, but they haven't really taken the profession or the legal industry by storm. Why all of this is so terribly important just now, I think, is for two different reasons. One is the economy, that increasingly I'm seeing businesses simply cannot afford legal services as traditionally and conventionally delivered. And secondly, and for me more significantly, we have a grave access to justice problem in most advanced jurisdictions, that unless you're very rich or very poor, it's quite hard to get hold of decent legal guidance. And so my passion is to think that businesses can be served more cost effectively and that citizens can be offered wider access to the law.
Hello. Andrew Dallas.
Andrew and Christine Osik, one of my senior project leads.
Great. Thank you for joining us. Andrew and Christina are at Full Spectrum Software. They are one of our target possible vendors on designing and implementing our digital virtual company software, and they've kindly undertaken to be part of the conversation as well. Do you we've introduced ourselves around the room. Do you want to add to that introduction anything?
Oops.
Hello?
This is.
Can you hear us?
Yes, we can hear you. I'm going to type them a note so that we can hear them.
Okay.
I don't have chat going yet. Can you hear us?
Yeah, we can hear you.
You're good.
We can hear
you. Oh, you can?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
And indeed, one of my question was, I gave you a brief introduction. Would you like to say a word or two about yourselves and your background?
Sure, I'd be happy to, as long as you can hear me. Just let me know if I drop out or something. This is Andrew Dallas, president of Full Spectrum Software. I assume that we've been introduced to some degree, but I'll give you the skinny. We've been in business for 14 years. We provide very specialized solutions for desktop and web, basically Windows, Linux, Mac, as well as web platforms. We have a very strong specialty in medical devices and scientific devices, but also in a lot of collaboration. Currently, we're working with the OPML. We've been working with the OPML sites for quite a few years now and are looking to that potentially to leverage it for storage and other features. I am a software engineer by trade and training, but I've been running the company for 14 years. I've got Christine Osik with me. She's one of my senior project leaders, excuse me, with substantial web services and web development expertise. And it's likely that she would be contributing to the project in some way if it's an appropriate fit technically.
Great.
So thank you. Okay.
We are just in the midst of sort of defining where the statement of the case, as it were, on what we're tackling here in terms of the opportunities for the use of the digital world in our design of legal services, law, that end of things. Richard, I'm sorry we interrupted you, or you.
I think I'd almost done. I was simply suggesting that the time is right now for the far more pervasive use of technology across the justice system, both in offering advice to citizens and in the way the courts work, A, because access to justice is becoming a dreadful problem, it seems to me, and B, that increasingly companies and businesses can't afford reliable legal advice. And so I think our collective interest is to see the ways in which technology might be able to creep into all corners of the justice system and begin to drive out some efficiencies. And what we see just now, I think, is an incredibly inefficient legal market.
I guess my sense of of what Richard's written about is a little broader, actually. And the question is, when or if these efficiencies actually change the system so much, so that's a very different kind of system. So just listening to the conversation thus far, I'm trying to get a sense, John, of what you were describing, but these evolving instruments or agreements, well, that's very, using the word agreement in a very different sense than document assembly, where they're still assembling documents. The documents are still coming out of printers. They're efficient, but whether they have the functionality you're talking about or thinking about, and whether they actually serve a purpose different from the documents, I think is a pretty interesting question.
That's right.
I had a thought of an analogy to the print media, and one of the issues that's facing that our world with respect to the vanishing of print media is a coming lack of provenance of the data that you see, and also a loss of the institutions that generated the data. And I wonder if that raises an interesting thing to think about with respect to the legal world.
Well, I think that your points taken together fit into some of the thinking we've had, which is that yes, exactly the processes of you're talking about, although they are relatively developed but not yet implemented, will drive a piece of the reform. But we're also trying to look beyond to say what happens when you move the institutions themselves into a digital form, into software. And then move them into a concept that we've been talking about of cloud law. If you've got cloud computing, can you have cloud law? Can you access legal devices, legal assurances, all that kind of thing through a digitized form? And what is the potentiality of that to move beyond what we do now, doing it better and faster and cheaper? And what will occur as we go forward?
I think in that narrower sense of developing online institutions or computer software-based companies and stuff, it kind of forces a revisitation of ideas of what the company is. I mean, is it a web of contracts or is it an institution on its own? Because with terrestrial or bricks and mortar companies, you have a place where the company lives and the boardroom and the fancy building, perhaps, that's the headquarters of the company. But if you move everything digital, it's what is the company, and is there some type of totem or avatar or something that you build this web of contracts around just to give a center to this thing? And I think it kind of forces us to revisit these questions of what is the essence of a constructed legal personality.
John, you have a.
I'm struck by the, as usual, the breadth and possibilities of the topic of this size. I mean, Brock's intervention is really about the nature of the firm, right? And that's kind of one huge aspect of legal theory and reasoning and practice. Of course, I take the broader statements maybe by Ethan and Richard and others to be talking about the provision of legal services more broadly, in the sense of, you're talking about the rich and the very poor have access, and there's a lot of people in the middle who don't, which I think is a different matter. So it seems to me that drawing four corners for what makes sense for a few hours to talk about is sensible, and to charge through it. And my sense is that either or both of those could be extraordinarily rich enterprises. And in the context of cloud law and the lab, they might both fit. But my sense is for the near term, I'd go in one of those directions or the other, or perhaps some third direction.
Gene, yeah.
So let me just throw maybe a different take. Some of you know I've been interested in what I've been calling a code law, or basically when law becomes code, as opposed to code becoming law, for Lessig. And this arises out of my experience looking at food stamps here in Massachusetts, but increasingly the way in which law is being executed through software code, either public law, as in benefits like food stamps, or private law, as in how contracts get executed. When you make a purchase via PayPal, there's a whole bunch of different things that are going on that are largely now software-based. And the challenge from a there's a couple of challenges. One is from a legal perspective, code is necessarily digital, and law has historically been very analog and is very based on kind of negotiated understandings. There's no room for ambiguity in digital code. Everything has to be specified up front, and a lot of the contingencies need to be thought through, or else it's not going to be captured by the software. So that's one challenge. And the other is then from a professional perspective, my sense is that a lot of other disciplines are now encroaching on what used to be considered the practice of law, such that software engineers are now creating contracts, at least the execution of contracts, rather than lawyers. And that's a challenge then to the profession as to whether that's good or something that we ought to be taking back as lawyers.
Can I just circle around? I think implicit in a couple of the observations, it's just this idea that a lot of current legal phenomena, how we contract, how we create companies, how we run the courts and so forth, is perhaps a function of a print-based world. And I suppose the most fundamental jurisprudential question one could ask is, what will legal institutions look like when we have completed the transition into a digital world? Will it be that we'll look back on the classic, again, this is a discussion, it's always occurred to me with clients that a number of clients will say the best agreement is the agreement that stays in the drawer and is never consulted. And that seems to me a bizarre way of looking at an agreement, which I thought was the guiding touchstone of an arrangement between two parties. But when agreements become this size, in what sense are they guiding anyone? And is this simply a function of the print-based world? Or as I say, fundamentally, in a digital world, might so many of the ways we look at legal phenomena be completely transformed? And I don't really know anyone who's looked into that in any depth.
I wonder if the distinction there is between the medium so much as the fact that digital agreements can be actually executed. Whereas paper is not self-executing, you can have code go and carry things out in a way that paper can't.
I had a conversation with my colleague Mark as we came down. He was talking about his practice having been helping to redesign San Francisco, but the practice, the relationship between a regulator and a project doer becomes potentially very different if the regulations become design algorithms, which are readable by design programs, and then can be shared back and forth. I don't know whether you'd.
It seems to me the ultimate implication of what you're talking about is changing the nature of human relationship. Human relationship. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that if that isn't changed, then the systems you're talking about haven't done their job. If you're going to, for example, truly change the nature of a law which defines how a building has to look and is continuously complained of as being too rigid by those who live with it and continuously complained of as being ineffective by those who administer it, and change that instead into an algorithm which gives architects an interactive way of relating with regulators and conceiving. Essentially, they wouldn't download it, it'd be in the cloud, but they would have the capability of essentially a tool which they could use to design a building within the parameters that would be much, much different than any of the parameters and more sophisticated and more pliable than any of the parameters that could be written down and published in a code. If that were true, if you could do that, then the way that would be reviewed would be instantaneous, and it would be different than spending $15,000 to print it up and carry it to a counter and give it to somebody and then have it in a planning commission. It would change the institution of the way review happened, which in turn would change the way regulation, to change the relationship between regulator and regulated community, right, which in turn would change society. And it seems to me that that's ultimately, if your systems are that you were talking about are truly effective, they will change. I mean, that's just the world I know. I'm sure that the whole world will change.
I mean, just to build on that, and I my interest is how to is in designing new kind of digital institutions, recognizing as you go on this week, it's not just adapting, it creates new opportunities and how to think about it. And so that when you think about it, how do you develop, I'm interested in sort of membership networks and how do you create, build trust and accountability and how do you make them resilient? And sort of thinking regulation is something outside, you make a design, but you design it into it. So you can design, you have a log of people's actions, you can collect metadata, you can build in transparency, you can design mechanisms that make it very difficult to game a system, you can trigger that, you can apply. So these things are not possible in the physical world that deal with a lot of institutional failures that we have now, and a way of scaling them in ways that you could never do before. So I think that we really have sort of, not tabula, but a real opportunity to rethink institutional design. And so from my vantage point, and cloud law is just the concept of the beginning of that, starting with this firm in Vermont, is sort of a way to, not just to start to think these ideas through, but actually run real-world experiments in the wild, actually people doing it, maybe get to it running it on Facebook or something else. That you're really starting to design institutions and you have levers that you can then manipulate to make more effective institutions.
In pushing law to executable code, I think one has to be a little careful to think that going after executable code is going to solve your problem, because software engineering is really hard. It's hard to specify what you want in a system. It's hard, it's nearly impossible to prove anything about a system that's interesting. So I don't think, you know, reaching for code is going to make everything better or okay. It's very interesting though, because it puts a lot of emphasis on process, which computer science, software engineering, in some sense, specializes in, even if it doesn't solve the problem of writing great code.
The thing is that it's already happening.
Right, but that means you're walking right into all the problems that you know code has.
Yep, exactly.
David, on the phone, are you?
David Johnson.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
David Johnson.
David, I think dropped off. I saw someone drop off.
Okay.
I think his connection was.
We can call him back.
Okay.
In the meantime, I was going to say one of the best books I've ever read about the transformation of law. At the hands of the movement from print to digital media is Ethan's book,
that's
you know.
Right.
And that's what, 12 years ago?
Well, I came this morning.
that's I'm not sure anyone has beat you yet in terms of capturing the transformational possibilities. And to me, one interesting dimension here is that even though we talk about documents, we tend to think of print. I mean, documents and institutions are really structures of meaning that are encoded through some sort of linguistic artifacts, and I don't think that's going to change. And even though we're doing it in a digital way, we're still going to have language and expression, whether it's executable or not. The kind of machinery and the design considerations and constructing those things really are isomorphic to what we've been doing in meat space for quite a long time. I mean, it opens up new opportunities for institution building and new forms of human interaction. But I think there's more continuity than we may be acknowledging at the moment in the underlying phenomena of building meaning together through language.
Well, I think that there will be obviously continuity, but there will also be discontinuity.
Sure.
You know, I think they're going to be hard to kind of predict where we are. Certainly, David Johnson's vision of the virtual company, which has been a part of what has been an inspiration for us going forward, is that it will open up a whole sets of design spaces that haven't been possible before in terms of collaborative interchange around certain kinds of projects, at any rate.
He's going to be loud for a second, because we can't call him from Skype.
Okay. So I don't know whether that may be the hinge to move from levels of generality to levels of specificity. I know that was part of what John was I think challenging us to do here.
It wasn't a challenge so much as I was trying to figure out, does it make sense to synthesize at the very highest level a series of things, or does it make sense to choose? Right, that was on.
I think that at least my own thought was to try and get some
David.
Of the. David.
Hi, sorry, the line dropped off for some reason.
Okay. Are you okay here, Dad David?
I can hear you.
Okay, very good.
I think we've got you on phone as opposed to Skype now, so we're We're doing multitasking of things. Or he's back through Skype or?
No, he's on the phone.
He's on the phone. Okay. Andrew, you still on the phone? On Skype?
Yeah, we're here. If you'd like, we can host a call-in conference through a service.
We're okay. I think we're doing all right. By the time we rearranged it, we'd sadly have lost a bunch of the time. But I want to make sure. Okay. But if you don't mind using that as a little bit of a hinge, maybe into some specific projects, may we at least put on the table our project? Would people feel that we had been unfairly capturing of the meeting? All right. What we've passed around here is a little bit of a current requirements outline, or at least functionality outline. But let me give a little background on this, if I may. The background is that partly as an outcome of discussions here at Berkman on digital institutions, on what that might look like, particularly going into a business entrepreneurial modality, we managed to get passed in Vermont a revisions to their LLC and corporations laws, which pushed this forward, I think. It essentially had three parts. One was authorizing a digital interface with the state. That's coming slowly, but it's coming, and that's not unique. Other places have that already in place. It authorized the use of digital communication in any structured form as a way of doing meetings or meeting substitutes and that kind of thing, so that what you dropped away was the requirement of either phones or paper of some form in the intercommunication aspect. Again, I think we're ahead on that. Other places are followed with that. I'm sorry, I live in Vermont, so I think of this as we. But finally, which I believe is a first for at least this domain of law, was the allowing of the structuring of the agreement to have the software be the primary instantiation of agreements. Mm-hmm. So software doesn't restate the agreement. Software is the agreement if we want it to be. And the effect of that is to permit at the kind of big visionary level, the David Johnson level, to permit a company of a million members. You could make Wikipedia, if it was for profit, could be organized as a company through this kind of a mechanism, where nobody ever did any form of communication other than through some kind of online interaction, and that would be fine. And it allows something like Wikipedia. You could have a million members, at least at this level of conception. There's no problem with having a million members with a vastly interactive assignment of benefits and roles. That people can volunteer out. The software can keep track of contributions and make allocations of revenues. We can have different classes of membership and who's on the exec. I mean, you can design the limitations are the imagination of the designer in effect, and the abilities of the software engineers to capture that and make that possible. On a more sort of homey and homely level, it also means that people who want to set up a five-person project of the classic kind of let's make a show I've got a barn, let's make a show. I've got a computer, let's make a YouTube contribution, which we want to own jointly. And part of the problem with that at the moment is, certainly most lawyers here know, is that if you just do that, you're a common law partnership with all of the downsides of that as your formal organization form. So we've got this law that's out there with all this potentiality. What do we do next? And at least a portion of what we want to do next is to work on software that would begin to be that software instantiation of the arrangement. Again, where the software is the original, it's not the derivative, it's not the product. We also view the fact that probably there will need to be hosting companies to help people set these up and provide the interfaces which these will need, through to such things as banking, workspace provision, other functionalities, accounting. What are the other functionalities that will be drawn into this? What are the other interfaces that people will need? And David, are you there and talkable on this? Because this is certainly one of your areas of specialty and expertise.
Yeah, I think the what I heard earlier in terms of what Richard and Mark are talking about and this idea do come together in a way, because for me, the important thing about digital being digital is that it's also global, and inevitably a large amount of the order in terms of relationships among people who are creating value together or pursuing joint purposes is going to have to come from contracts in effect. And those contracts are going to have to be easy to form and easy to operate under in an online environment. So I think there is, I have trouble when people treat the problem solely in terms of taking existing legal structures and building them into automated systems, although that's a worthwhile thing to do, and I in favor of that. I think the other thing that what the net will do here is to put a premium on the ease with which people can enter into relationships that when they're coming from anywhere and when what they're doing is creating value or pursuing joint purposes together.
Sounds like we've lost some connection to audio here.
Hosting company is to keep them Andrew, are you appropriately and seeing themselves?
Yeah, well, I can hear you.
Acting together as a group.
Okay, we've had the other speaker on, which is not coming through to you. Sadly, that was David Johnson talking about the need to make sure we have contracting more widely available through digital means and not just in terms of traditional formats. Anyway, we'll go back and forth as we need to, but. So reactions to David's?
I'm very familiar with this, and I'm all in favor of entrepreneurial activities, but I think Edwina's point, if I understood her right, was a kind of, maybe she was a little more subtle than I would have been, the kind of warning that you build things into software code. You can't really anticipate everything that's going to happen. Paper contracts, have the value of establishing a relationship at a particular point in time. That has all, it's not flexible, but usually know what you're getting. In the dispute area, what we find is, it's not actually the bugs in the software. That's just one kind of dispute. It's when the software works. When the software works and is used and scales, then you have problems you have to deal with. And entrepreneurs, David's the exception here because he put dispute resolution in. Entrepreneurs rarely think there are going to be any disputes because they think the software is going to work. Maybe you disagree with that. If you think the software is going to work, then you don't have to, this is wish fulfillment at the extreme. So I view these things as experiments, and they're good experiments, but I think it's worth using, at least consider for a moment that these are experiments. They have a purpose, but they're going to have other consequences.
In a way, Oliver, isn't there a real... I want to go back to something that Richard was saying, which is people negotiating big agreements and then putting them on the shelf and never looking at them. I did agreements where this was small, and multi-volume development agreements between over huge projects that took 2 years to negotiate and then weren't looked at.
They're designed for disputes, though, aren't they?
They're designed entirely to be looked at when there's a problem.
Right.
But the when I was listening to you, I was thinking, could we have a more flexible future where these documents in some way, if they don't exist as documents, but they exist as alternative realities that the parties imagined, which could then be consulted, would we somehow not always put them in the drawer? And certainly making them more rigid at the start as software code is not would not accomplish that purpose. It reminds me of I had a practice where I drafted initiatives, in California, things that were people wrote the law and voted on them. And it was the most horrifying thing you ever can do because you were trying to sit at one moment in time and try to figure out what would happen in the future. And in fact, you have no idea what's going to happen in the future. The reason that people put agreements in the drawer is they know that once they've done the agreement, all that matters is their relationship. And you just go forward with the world. So some,
Well, which actually is a piece of how this what we've got here on the table is being designed. If I may, would it be out of place to just walk through quickly what we're envisioning here? This would be a piece of software that would be aimed, at least currently we're thinking about aiming it as a Facebook application. Why? Because people come together and you know they meet, they socialize in Facebook. It would be aimed as providing a framework within which to have a project among people who, at least many of whom, start out knowing each other, that kind of a world. And it really mirrors the current small partnership and LLC default rules to a large degree. Because, and again, those default rules have evolved over time. They are based around consensus. They're based around, you know, relatively equal sharing. They're based around small group communication and dynamic at a level where trust exists. And if trust stops existing, then the thing falls apart, and we either get rid of the person who's the problem, or we dissolve the whole thing. As you're essentially two alternatives for that to go forward. So as we saw the structures, first of all, there's a bunch of formation steps. There's the faith interface with the state. John, do you have a copy of this, or do you have a?
Yes.
Okay, great. There's the interface with the state. There is the necessity maybe for an intermediary in there, but there's also a set of setting out things in the formation process. We would actually set out a bunch of things. Who is going to be a part of this? Again, in a bigger, more futuristic version, we'd recruit and, you know, drop an ad. You know, the kind of wiki company would drop an ad all the time. This would take instead the view, you know, who's going to join early? Who is the who are we defining in? And any additions would be required to have everybody who's already in say yes to. That's the classic sort of default rule partnership approach. We'd need security aspects, obviously. We'd need to make sure that we had identity keys. And indeed, as John is a specialist in this, one of the things that he points out is that actually your identity could be one of the key elements in defining your attributes. That one way to program it might be to make a lot of these things assignable back to your identity, and then your voting rights, your sharing rights, all of that kind of thing.
Can be
tagged in that kind of way. We need some kind of accounting loop where we figure out what the initial contributions look like, what people are bringing to the table in terms of money and other contributions. How do we allocate profit and loss when we got this going? Withdrawals and distributions. This is the classic partnership capital account style accounting. If anybody's been a law partner, they've seen this, right? And at least in the U.S., that's the classic form. We would again expect to use that in this kind of a context rather than doing something more fancy. There would be budget development and tracking. One of the questions here is interfacing with budgeting software. You know, can we have it be imported? What's the nature of our workspace for planning? What's the nature for our workspace for doing the project? Those workspaces probably somewhat separable, so that the planning workspace becomes that available to the participants. The doing the project workspace may be a different place. Bank interface, question of automatic or human review. In this case, although there are potential bank partners on this, our current plan would be to have it actually be via sneaker from somebody who had a designated role as the person to work with the bank. It doesn't have to be automated. We would hope that it would be, and that we would make that automated fairly early on once we identify the kinds of bank partners that we could have. Third-party receipt and payment is also in there. We need to be able to take in income and make payments to other parties. Again, that automating that would be wonderful, but it's not a necessary point. Management and decision making. In some ways, the most interesting aspect of this: how do you make plans and projects? How do you assign roles? Again, in a simple project company, our view is that people will do that kind of coming in. If it's around, particularly say a YouTube video project, who's gonna shoot things? Who's gonna edit? Who's gonna sell? There'll be a set of reasonably defined expectations about roles that we could help them set and set who's gonna do what going forward. With some kind of check off of when it's been done satisfactorily from around the group to monitor how it's going. One we would view this participatorily. One other a classic model is to set a managing partner and have the manager do it all and do that kind of assigning and all that kind of thing. It opens up a different set of dynamics. It would be possible to do. Again, we're trying to design the decision making as being a locus in a tree that could be then either consensus based, because I said so based, whatever, but at least as we program, we would see it as a place where we would have a go no go kind of decision, and what was the formal aspect of that could be variable as we go forward. Release points, contracts, commitments. What do we do for a commitment to the outside world? Voting, unanimity. This model would probably be built around a unanimity model for things, partly because it's just simpler, partly because it also, tying back into the dispute resolution kinds of questions, is one that has a clear possibility for stopping, and the unanimity requirement is a form of solution to dispute resolution. It's not an ideal one in all circumstances, but at least it backstops that. Tasks and output, we would need some kind of performance space. Also roles of non-owners, can we bring in people who would be other kinds of contractors, that kind of thing. Sales, customer relations, we would need a functionality for that, we felt. Amendments and changes, how do we change this thing? And again, the simple rule is unanimity. If you go in and say, you know, any change, and this again is the default rule for both partnerships and LLCs in the U.S., if you have a unanimity rule, it is a simple, if not always, uncumbersome approach.
Just going back, you skipped over ownership of IP.
Oh, sorry, yes, ownership of IP.
That just raised for me the question, do you imagine that would be accomplished through some kind of a quasi-traditional contract among the participants?
Exactly. And indeed, one of the reasons to have one of the main reasons to have a company is to have a locus for IP.
Right.
That we've been talking.
Assignment by the participants to the company.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Always through a relatively traditional contract, as opposed to some software artifact that expresses that.
Well, the software artifact. Well, good point. I mean, the notion would be that the software artifact would be the assignment to this. But your point is well taken. That you may want to make sure that you've satisfied the needs of the copyright assignment rules, which are not as flexible as the Vermont company rules yet.
I can just understand the distinction between having a license and having the software code or otherwise function as the license.
Well, I'm trying to clarify. Was there some vision of just having an interactive system that people engage in, and by virtue of their engaging in it constitutes a transfer of ownership? Or doesn't there need to be some document, digital in form, that people must send to electronically?
I would have assumed that there's the equivalent of a click-through.
Yeah, that's
right. One of the terms of becoming a member of this company would be, by the way, here's the IP term.
Right.
Yes. You know, Okay.
Okay, because earlier you suggested, we're kind of, it's going to be pure original software as opposed to some kind of a document or a contract.
Well,
there will be traditional agreements to which people...
Yes, but the agreements are in the software and realized through the software rather than necessarily. I mean, this would be one that would probably be good to have a statement of, which is a good point.
It has to be translated from software language to English or whatever the
human language.
There is some human language projected expression of what I've agreed to.
Although again, that human language expression may not be as fully realized as we would have it. Who's the member?
Mm-hmm.
Who gets to vote? Unanimity will reign. Okay, and then that would be then the software takes over in a sense and is the original of that as well. At least a piece of the vision. Did we lose David again?
Yeah, it's redialing him.
Okay. So this is and then keeping going here. Disputes as we're at least currently envisioning disputes, and I would love to hear thoughts on this. Is that we would have the ability to flag an unhappy flag. I'm unhappy, and there's a dispute. Then some kind of unanimity chat room around which we work to resolve that dispute. If when everybody signs, again, it's a unanimity model, when everybody signs off, yes, we're okay, we're back in sync, then we go forward. If we're deadlocked over time,
the classic approaches to deadlock are can the withdrawal of the person, if you're down to one person who's holding everything up, you know, you have a kind of either a voluntary slash forced withdrawal around that deadlock with some kind of agreed consequence to pay out over time. So hopefully it's not voting off the island kind of approaches, or the thing dissolves and stops, and we have some kind of transaction that again, that is the classic small business partnership default dispute resolution kind of approach. You're looking
No, just listening.
Okay.
Do you imagine a situation where, I mean, is this really just for simple transactions? Do you imagine a situation where people might have, as part of their operation, processes that need dispute resolution mechanisms? For example, mm-hmm. let's say that part of what you do as part of the business is setting prices for things.
Right.
Or let's say a setting price for real estate. You want to have offer people mechanisms that they could choose among for reaching agreement that are a little more sophisticated than, I mean, you know, there are so many, if in the real estate world, there are a half dozen ways to resolve disputes about appraisals that are motivate you to agree by the way they're structured.
And the answer is yes, that particularly going forward. Again, what I'm positing here is a really simple-minded initial use case. Uh-huh. And it's meant to be simple-minded because, quite frankly, I want to do exactly the kind of thing you're talking about, which is build it as a little bit of an experiment. What does it look like when you build this kind of thing? When you use this kind of approach to build, what are the things you trip over? Can we solve the problems in a simple way for what are intended to be kind of upfront sell, you know, identified simple? This is a simple company. This isn't a complicated company. Go see your lawyers. If you want complicated companies, go see your lawyers. If you want advice about the simple company, but I know within if you want to have a fairly straightforward project, five or six people coming together through digital means to have you want a wraparound structure that could work, here's one. And if you like the way this one's
without
set up,
too many choices to set it up.
Exactly. Yeah, now, initially. The ultimate goal. And David, are you back?
Yeah, I'm here.
The ultimate goal, as expressed by people like David, is to have an extremely flexible instrument within which all kinds of definitions are possible. And it can be flexible off the rack. It can be flexible bespoke. I mean, you know, there's a bunch of different possibilities in this. Just looking at the current who sets up what kind of companies, the expectation is the majority of people wanting to use it would be perfectly happy with the simple. But that the most interesting cases will be the big and difficult. For instance, one of the things we do with Vermont is looking into some of the new methods of doing energy distribution and all that kind of thing. Energy buying cooperatives in the future could be set up in something like this. An energy buying cooperative would look very different than what I'm putting on the table here, and would need you know much much more complicated versions of these things.
Yeah, I think a question that I'd like to ask, it relates to just what you said now and some of the things that Richard was saying. And it's kind of like the user or the person who walks up to one of these systems is self-selecting to be in the system. And one of the things that a consultation with a human lawyer might do for you when you're about to sign up for something is to explain the pros and cons, what you're getting, all of those kinds of nuanced things, which are sometimes hard to get if you don't have some guidance in asking the right questions. So it seems to me the role of explanation or saying to the user what the ramifications of their various choices are is very, very important. I mean, the naive user might think, well, it's just going to go hunky-dory, I'll never have to have a dispute, right? I mean, they're kind of a wishful thinking. Or someone who worries about every possible way that this whole thing might fall apart. I mean, so it seems that the person who's signing up to go this route needs to understand what they're signing up for, and that can be an interesting problem in its own to sort of describe.
Yes.
This goes back sort of on like what Gene was saying in the nuance of the law, and then you come back and you say, well, can ideally law be codified so that it has no ambiguity and that it has no sort of interpretation?
Well, Well, and as I say, at least a piece of what we're doing here is saying, you know, the simple-minded aspect of this is if you require unanimity as you go forward on most things, then people have got the ability to
right.
To,
but if you know, if you think you can get away with unanimity, but you don't. But you don't understand what that really means. I mean, when you say I'll use this dispute resolution mechanism, do you understand what you're signing up for? I mean, sometimes you find out what you've signed up for only too late.
Right. But right. The other problem with that though is that even if you go the traditional route and the lawyer says, "Wouldn't you like this?" Everybody nods and goes, "Sure."
I understand. So the problem exists in its old paper-based ways too.
But I take your point.
Yeah. Okay.
I do think, I mean, I think there's an opportunity. And when I think about the area that we're talking about in privacy and security and identity, there are different kinds of regimes that you can have that have different kind of protections and their
right.
kind of benefits. And so you try to design something that's fairly robust and you get a third party to vouch for it. You say, so it's like, we're going to be like a creative kind. It might be an icon that says, this is a Class A enterprise. It is good for this.
Right,
But do not try this with more than two people or members of your family or with members of your family.
Right.
It'll destroy everything. And here are the weak points. And then you can have, and then what I like about the sort of experimental law is the idea that you can start to say, well, why does this thing really fail? And why we're, and so maybe we'll design into something. In other words, I think reputation systems, I get on my rant about identity and reputation, but I think those are very important to create transparency. And so if people are willing to submit to that, then actually it makes it robust against these kinds of weaknesses. So you sort of disclose that and then say nothing's perfect. But and then over periods of time, people will vouch for these things. Because I think at some point the complexity is such that, I mean, having done a number of startup companies and getting shareholder agreements like that where you get a senior partner who has a different reading of it every time you pay $800 an hour, you say, well, what do we got? You know, and every contingency in the world. And so can you, within a membership network, can you agree to certain conventions that you'd be bound to? And can you simplify it that way? And know that with doing that, there are different kinds of risks that you're willing to take, and so they have different kind of provisions in these different kind of networks.
Yeah, so in some sense what you're doing is you're negotiating a map between the problem space, the needs of the people
right.
setting it up, and the solution space, which are these various choices and the parameterized kind of
right.
system.
That's right. And then over time, if you look at it as a kind of technology, then you say, well, here, let's see, evolve, let's try to make this relatively robust in this kind of problem space or period of time. And have various parties certify that, actually. You may even want to underwrite it. They've been able to absorb kind of risk around that. Yes.
I could just jump back to midway through your comment, John. You noted this idea of finding points of failure.
Right.
And I mean, there's one way to think about what we're talking about, what Oliver's described, which is really just automating very quickly the ability to create a firm. But we're also thinking about it, as you describe it, as a study mechanism, right?
Right.
A way to have a methodology that says,
right.
how do we figure out whether these versions that we created
right.
are back going to succeed or not? So
that's right.
You may have this already set up in your architecture, but the ability, in fact, to have some feedback mechanism for how
Absolutely.
Things fail
that's
over
right.
time, and then to be able to track in a way that software is good at, or human beings are good at using software to do,
right.
Then correcting for those errors.
I mean, I think that's really key to that. I mean, you have you're collecting metadata on every
right.
move that everyone's
right.
making.
Yeah.
So you've got logs, which you never had before
right.
in the physical world. I mean, that's
kind
very
of exhaustively
profound.
Self-documenting.
It's self-documenting.
It is. One
wow.
of the things that with a service such as David Johnson's would be the question of whether the participants through a hosting service would agree that their host would keep in some kinds
yes.
of anonymized way a database on all of this. It's like the Microsoft, you know, do you want an error message sent kind of thing, only perhaps even less voluntary than that.
Mm-hmm.
But just as if you're talking about designing the software,
right.
the administrative interface effectively to collect and make sense of those metadata clearly is a major undertaking, not a, it'll just be collected in log files and we'll be able to sort it.
Absolutely
so,
huge.
My sense would be that would be in a way what separates this as a research project from
right.
simply doing it in the
right.
way that you're describing as well.
mean, part of the identity system is a way of tracking everyone that everyone's doing, and you can anonymize it, and you can.
I see the parallel. I'm only saying that if you're thinking, it's almost, I don't know what the emphasis is, but 50-50, right? In terms of design, or some very large percentage on the.
Andrew, as a potential software designer into this space, would that be something that would be relatively easy to build in, or does it become more difficult, this kind of notion of tagging and data collection as one goes forward?
Well, it's really very interesting. I think the the tracing and the traceability and sort of the grouping of information that we'd be tracking could be incredibly valuable. One of the things that we seem to be coming back to pretty frequently is dispute resolution and, you know, the rules of the game. And to my mind, that always brings to mind arbitration by third parties. You know, that's something that everybody can agree to. You don't have to have in code all of the rules to make good decisions. And perhaps a mechanism, you know, a Turk-type model where you have qualified individuals who have credentials that are a blessed and can perform the valuable service of being an arbiter, and maybe get over time rated as arbiters for dispute resolution, would be in itself a valuable system to develop. You know, the eBay model of gaining stars or credits as an arbiter would allow one to sort of come up through the ranks and provide real value.
Okay.
Wide audience, and again, go ahead.
I was just going to say that you guys have given some thought to some of this. I would.
There are dispute resolution itself is a complex activity. There are lots of dispute resolution processes. Frank Sander down the street, famous for saying, let the forum fit the fuss. Arbitration works for a lot of things. Mediation might be more desirable in other contexts. ICANN has this arbitration process. It's efficient, but some people think not particularly fair. I was involved with one arbitration endeavor with ICANN at the beginning. Well, you might think transparency is good, but when people find out that one of the providers rules in favor of trademark owners 60% of the time and the other rule in favor of the trademark owners 85% of the time, well, the 60% people go out of business.
Because, forum shopping.
These are complex things, and,
things. That's a really good point, but I think that metadata can be captured, and it would. There is some scalability that could work here, that you could really form a jury of decision makers to help in arbitration.
eBay
as a different type of arbitration.
I'm going to get a phone call in 2 seconds. I apologize for that, but eBay actually has a jury system, a virtual jury system, which you can play around with. Voting systems are another, you know, they're complex. Different voting systems lead to different likelihoods of results.
Yeah, but just to that point, I think, because we played around this thing called smartocracies and how people rate each other, but the whole question of being have a pretty precise notion of what transparency is around certain kind of attributes and certain kind of conditions, and so it's not just say transparency, it's be very precise as to what that is. Allows you to design mechanisms that may be more appropriate to the form. I think that is sort of the opportunity here. Whereas right now we're in a physical world, it's you can't do that.
I think what you have the opportunity to do by manipulating variables is having an experiment and figuring out where things end up. eBay, you know, has its reputation system. It also has 40 million disputes a year it handles. So the reputation system.
But they do a lot of it. I mean, they used to do a lot of it automated.
They still do. That's the other challenge. You can, you know, monetary disputes, they're easy to solve. There's software that can do that very nicely and elegantly because computers can deal with numbers. But relationship disputes are harder. We actually characterize the use of technology in the dispute resolution arena as kind of a fourth party, third party model is the human. The fourth party doesn't replace the third party, but it can guide results. It can assist. It can do all kinds of things.
Are you contemplating a world in which if someone, I decide I'm going to use this software to create a small company, that I have in some way agreed to record the results of what I do such that they're trackable, so that if we end up dissolving because we have a dispute, I have a contractual or other obligation not to just walk away, but to report that we dissolved and what happened?
The software will report.
I had a contractual obligation to do something.
So, in other words, if I'm participating in the software,
Your call may be recorded to improve service, and
if I'm participating, if I walk away from the software, it knows it.
My sense is that the Microsoft error reporting is probably the right analogy. Now, I'm just reading into what these guys are talking about, but saying I think there's, if we want to go from the provide a service that is an efficient online way to doing it to doing this also as a research project that has a feedback loop, you have to join that particular question, which says, my sense is you probably would do it in a way that said you may, you know, the default is that you give the data, and if you really don't want to give the data, you probably can use it with, I don't know exactly, knowing the rules of default, most people would then do it. But I think you're quite right. There are all manner of, either privacy or Heisenbergian or other problems that might.
It's a huge, not only is it a huge issue, but it's a potentially transformative one. Because so many areas of the law, not so much transactional business, which crosses boundaries all the time, but certainly real estate, for example, where the way people do deals in San Francisco, it's a community, and they know what happens when deals fall apart and what your tools are, but they don't talk to the people in New York or Cleveland these communities don't talk to each other. And so a system which actually kind of had some sort of feedback that gave somebody all this knowledge would give somebody a lot of power.
Well, again, this is part of the Law Lab idea, is that we work from back and forth from application to research as we go forward.
Yeah, I've seen one of the tremendous potential benefits of doing it online and having this Law Lab where you collect data is that you can learn from the data. I mean, there are lots of learning mechanisms that can munch on data and make some inferences about things. I mean, classifications or one thing or another. You can even test out the control regimes. And then your system, ultimately, you have to make a decision, should probably adapt to this so that your law lab environment actually learns. I mean, lawyers learn, firms learn. I mean, and that's one of the most valuable things about people is that they learn. And if you give your systems the ability to learn, you're beginning to get at something very fundamental. But you can't do it without data.
Right. I mean, but I think in this world, right, in the Web 2.0 world, I mean, you've got the spore of your conduct is being collected by everybody.
It's true, but one way to think about it might be exactly this, which is if you offer people to have the benefit of the learning of the software, maybe that's a reason for them to participate in an anonymized way, which is to say you can see points of failure that other people have. Over time. Now, obviously, it doesn't help the first 1,000 people.
An excellent point, which is that if you've got a homepage, you know, come learn about these things. By the way, here's our prose description of why unanimity is can be fraught. You know, there we go. If you want a more tailored thing, here's six lawyers to talk to.
Your second YouTube video, you might.
But he's suggesting if you give your data, you get everybody else's data.
But it's more nuanced than that.
Or at least you get cumulatized versions.
Yeah, you can get aggregated, be anonymized. It can be. I mean, there.
Or the inferences.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message.
Oh, I love it.
Right. The point is, the software would then prompt you if you are participating in it. You'll get a little dialogue box that said, 78% of people who go this direction are screwed up,
right? Clippy revisited, right?
Right.
That's quite formal data. I'm interested in the community dimension. Yeah. That the more I speak to non-lawyers about the law, they, with all the will in the world, benefit often more from speaking to other non-lawyers who've been in the same position rather than speaking to lawyers. And what interests me in the whole idea of online community is that you could create discussions of personal experiences, which is less formal than the data you're talking about. But what does this actually mean in practice? What did it mean for you and so forth? And you may say, why will people bother contributing? But that is the phenomena, this Web 2.0, that if people are part of a community and they have the various features of the community, somehow they feel impelled or motivated to exchange views. And so what excites me about this idea is that you actually have a kind of living set of experiences recorded around.
That's very Shankian. I mean, Roger Shank at Yale, with all the emphasis on dynamic memory and stories and explanations and things like that. I mean,
a user blog that ran concurrently with the thing itself might be a very interesting piece of the whole setup.
I actually think in the future it's going to be funded. There's a legal philosopher talking about the living law, but I actually think that will be the living law, is people's personal stories, renditions, explanations of how they coped, and that will resonate with others in a way that formal legal doctrine, formal legal language, legal experience.
My testimonies that people have with respect to certain things, and so they have a reputation that other people say, okay, and then I'll read that.
We're a million miles away from that, but for me, this is what access to justice will be about. That access to justice won't necessarily be. Yeah, I also say exactly. But if we get a neighbor, you get a dispute over your boundary. Often people will prefer to speak to someone else who sorted that out. And how did you manage to do that? And this is informal, it's experiential. Yes.
So one of the things that's interesting about that is the blog is sometimes not a very useful form of this story or this case because it rambles. I mean, so there's an interesting little challenge to get the narrative down to something that's a little more, in some sense, like a case. And then, of course, there's the retrieval aspect. Here you are with your dispute with your neighbor, and you'd like to find out other disputes with either the particular neighbor or, you know, in this particular town or this community. So it raises a very, very interesting set of issues
back again and again to when you have problems with your, some of us have problems that with your laptop. I think you should move to a Mac and a few things, just wondering how to sort it out. My inclination immediately now is simply to Google it, and you find a community of experience. Yes. And often the people who are, they're not experts, but actually they share my particular position. Just move to Entourage, this is a problem, boomf. Now, that's not reading a manual, it's not speaking to a specialist, it's drawing on this this body of experience that we seem to be building up, whether it be about what we thought of a hotel, how we sorted out a personal computer, so forth. And I don't see why law should be immune from this kind of debate.
Environments of various kinds.
Like patients like me in the medical context, this would be companies like us.
Yes, yes.
You can find fellow travelers who have been down your institutional path, raised and dealt with issues.
But how do you deal with the element of contract, which is an attempt to take a moment in time and decide, where everyone decides which mechanism you're going to do? Because if you wait until later, then people will discover, and if their information is better through your online community, they'll discover it faster, that this way of doing it is better for me, and that way of doing it is better for you. How are we going to decide whether we do it this way or that way, without having decided it earlier when we weren't in that situation? That's what contracts are about. How do you deal with that?
Well, again, the unanimity principle is a version of that solution. It's a crudest version, but it says that when we go forward, everybody, you know, if we get to step B and you know, it doesn't, we got to all re-decide around the new reality, and we don't leave anybody out of that decision. It's crude. It leads to deadlock, but it is at least a way of saying when you get to the future and the veil, it's like the Rawlsian veil of ignorance. When we get there and we know, then we know our roles. Okay, now what are we going to do? Well, we all have to agree on whatever that next piece is. But it's crude, and you can have more sophisticated versions of it going forward.
I'm not. Because I would think that'd be an opportunity to do all the innovation in terms of developing mechanisms to cope with that. I mean, again, that's part of the experimental framework. I mean, the whole idea of evolvable law is actually, you can see you evolve different kind of contracts, you see under different kind of agreements where they become usurped from one party to the next. So you're anticipating future events, and then you're trying to develop a robustness against those future events. Now, you can't be 100% sure, but you can say, well, so, and you know when you do this, I mean, in startup companies and you're dealing with a VC and you're reading the various agreements and all these triggers and provisions, and you're trying to do the decision tree to say where I end up, well, they've done it a lot more than you have. and so the point is for a naive person to come in and say, well, you know, the probable events is this is how it's going to end up. But once you do represent it in a digital form, then you can actually start to analyze these things in a fairly rigorous way, which you just can't do in a printed form.
Well, I must admit, I'm very grateful because I've gotten at least five really good ideas of the things that I need to think about more fully on this. But I don't want to cut us off prematurely, but I also want to make sure that we get into other subject matters that people will want to put out. Is there any other kinds of use cases that people would want to put on the table to the group to think about while we're here? Yes, Brock.
I'm not sure if this is the appropriate time to do this, but I'll go ahead. Kind of synthesizing some stuff I picked up from Gene and also your cautionary tales from this end of the table over here. I'm thinking of Danielle Citron's article about the technological due process and trying to automate the welfare various different types of systems along those lines. We're trying to do that in the corporate sense, and there are tons of horror stories in there about what can go wrong and how it's bad, and we're essentially trying to bring a similar thing to bear on corporate and internal affairs. So I think there's a lot that can be learned from the stories that come out of automating these welfare benefits and such.
Here, and again, one of the reasons why at least our target is a very specified, you know, simple-minded, close to the default rules approach as a starting point is to please try not to create through elaborateness the pitfalls that we'll hit.
Perhaps the biggest thing that can be learned is that there needs to be a human override, and lots of places I'm remembering, especially the state of Colorado, didn't provide the human override because they were lazy and they thought they were going to save tons of money. So I think we can dispense with one of the biggest dangers in that thing immediately by just providing for a human override when the software comes out with ridiculous answers by mistake.
Other things. What are folks up to into this space that we ought to? We've been very very generous in letting us, you know, describe what our project is. What any other projects that we should know? Right? I mean, Richard, you're consulting with folks on exactly this all the time. Any of this that you can share?
It's not as sophisticated as this in many ways. The largest firms in the world that I work with, they're not thinking in this way. They're. I'm really impressed and interested in the discussion, but. A lot of their work, and I think it parallels the work that you're doing in document assembly, they look at two things. One, they look at areas of work just now that they think are done rather inefficiently that they can, as I'll right. say in my talk at lunchtime, automate, so not changing it in any way, simply say we can take some of the costs out of that. And secondly, there's what I call a latent market, where a lot of law firms are interested in working with clients and sorting out problems that currently receive very little legal attention at all. So if you take something like, maybe one I'll talk about at lunchtime, I don't know, but the generation of term sheets by banks, term sheets being the basic statement of the broad conditions under which a bank's prepared to offer finance. And often it's terribly important because that really sets the tone and the content of the discussions for the loan documentation. But who drafts the term sheets just now? It isn't done by external skilled lawyers. It tends to be done within banks and done rather badly. Basically, banks can't afford to get law firms to retain law firms to do this. So a number of firms have seen a real opportunity here. I can think of two in London, one in California. But what they've managed to do is develop a term sheet generator where someone just answers a series of questions and out comes a fairly polished first draft. And I call that the latent market because that's not work that the law firm would otherwise be doing, but it's helping clients in ways that previously were not actually reachable by conventional legal service. But again, both of these, I mean, advanced they may be in one sense, in terms of your own thinking, they're not advanced at all. They're simply streamlining the process of creating documents. You're actually thinking of changing processes.
Right.
You're challenging processes. And it goes back to my earlier point about when I make at lunchtime, but whether or not when you're dealing with technology, you're talking about automation or innovation. Automation, computerizing what already goes on, innovation, doing things that previously weren't possible without the technology. And I think you're very much in the innovation camp, whereas a lot of the work that even the most advanced law firms are doing is still in the automation arena.
That's quite correct.
So I wouldn't look to the profession for any, genuinely, even I think I work with some of the world's most advanced law firms, technologically speaking, but this is not a space they're yet in.
Do you think it's a space they might be in, or do you see it as and you and Mark, you're also right in the midst of all of this. I mean, is the distinction I've made in my own head is between digitally assisted drafting and pure digital instantiation drafting as a kind of a distinction.
I can give you one current example. It's kind of fun. It's a client of ours that's actually Morocco and a U.S. law firm that's been advising them about their sales agreement process to construct very well-crafted sales agreements this company can enter into with its customers, to have those built electronically, and to build a regime that controls what the salesperson can do and what kind of flexibility they have in terms of terms and what requires management approval. So the processes involve building this web-based contract construction environment that a salesperson initiates on behalf of some customer. They go through and as long as they come within the lines, they can generate a document that's perfectly complete and it's pre-blessed by the law department, right? And if they make some choices that go outside of the permissible boundaries, it raises a flag that then causes this to be printed out with a watermark on it that says draft, management approval required. So it's kind of an embedding sure. of rules in the very process. It's fascinating because it goes to Edwin's point also about the complexity of automating. You would think a 20-page contract can't be that complicated, but when you start to actually automate all the permutations and variations mm-hmm. and put this layer of management approval on top of it, the amount of back and forth between the business people, the law firm that's looking at this from a legal and compliance and risk management point of view, and the technologists like us, it's phenomenally complex. But once you get it to work, you've got a reasonably complete artificial institution for generating contracts in this particular environment. I think that stuff's beginning to happen all over the map. And to answer your question, will law firms be doing it? I think they're going to have to. That's going to be part of the new way in which you practice law.
Is this system fielded?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm just curious, what's the percentage of instances that need to go back and be approved?
It's not yet live. That's going to be about 2 weeks will be live.
Very interesting.
So I can answer that question.
Yeah,
not. I have to confidentiality issues.
Yeah, sure.
But you'll be able to study, but they'll be able to study, because then it gives them a window, just like for you, the learning opportunities. They can then look at their business at a much more conceptual level and say, look at what's happening. We're routinely getting these kinds of requests for variation over terms.
Yes.
And so we can adjust the regime. We can tighten or loosen
the market opportunity here.
It's a fascinating kind of knowledge engineering challenge. And I think that's beginning to happen all over the landscape. So
other projects that be fun to put to the crowd
But when Gillian gave her talk, you had to talk about the private law production, and she was making an argument saying that part of the problem is that there should be more like a market structure, and in England's ahead of the U.S. and this is an area I know very little about, but you have sort of a special guild that is captive. The reason you don't get the innovation is there really isn't an incentive. It's monopolies. So you have a whole series of monopolies taking place. And so if you're going to really open this thing up to innovation, you're going to have to break some of those monopoly holds and open up to different players. I guess with David, in the U.K. is a lot further. What does it take for that to happen in the U.S. versus... Because the U.K. is a lot further along than the U.S. in this, right?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no.
Gillian was arguing the ability to have non-lawyers be partners in law firms meant that you could actually have a technology lawyer combination
right.
that would...
You don't have to be a law firm to generate these agreements.
The point I was making this morning in our discussion with the webcast, the difference... Do people know about the 2007 Legal Services Act? The only 10 seconds?
No, yeah, maybe that would be good.
It's just a bit... I mean, there's various things, pieces of legislation. It's basically about the modernization of the the profession. Part of it's to do with how disputes are resolved in the profession, and part of it's to do with the regulation of the profession. The most interesting thing, I think, is that it enables external investors to invest capital in law firms. It enables non-lawyers to become partners in law firms. And it enables, by implication, non-lawyers to be heavily involved in the management of law firms. And I'm on the advisory board of a private equity firm that's actually going to invest in the business because of this. And what's fascinated me was that what they're less interested in is investing in conventional legal businesses, because conventional legal businesses are firmly entrenched. They have their pyramidic organizational structure. They have their hourly billing model. They have their expensive buildings. They have their, many partners are, I think, all good. We'll get some investment, and we can take some capital out of the business and sail off into the sunset.
Do that early.
Now, that is just not how private equity people are looking at it. They're looking at it in this way. They say, well, the market for legal services in the UK is worth £24 billion, and a lot of that seems to be done very inefficiently. We're pretty sure we could deliver some of that service at less cost and in a more client-facing way. So what they may want to do is buy the brands, the reputations of firms.
Love it.
But the businesses
itself, 1 million per chances too.
So the businesses that they invest in are they're unlikely to continue carrying on business in the same way. Now the observation that's often made, and again, I said this in the podcast this morning, is that this doesn't affect U.S. and Canadian firms, and I argue the reverse, because what this is going to give rise to is maybe 3 or 4 or 10 businesses in the English legal system, but actually far more fundamentally, it's going to give insight into how legal work can be done differently. And that's not, the fact that that's enabled through external investment, external management, doesn't mean it's irrelevant for other jurisdictions.
No, it'll be demanded by the customer.
Indeed. So if I'm the CEO of a company in the US and I hear there's new ways of managing legal risk or resolving disputes or drafting documents, the fact it's been inspired by external investment or by more business-like people running law firms is irrelevant. And so I don't think, although the U.S. is more inclined to protect law firms from external investment, the consequence of external investment is actually different ways of delivering legal service. And this is what really fascinates me. In relation to your own work, what I'm finding the private equity people, they are just looking at all technologies and all new techniques, for anything, for example, call centers. And this is perhaps for the high volume, lower value work, but anathema to almost every law firm historically, the idea that you wouldn't actually sit face to face with a client. But when we're looking at personal injury, when we're looking at probate, when we're looking at all of the lower end work, and we're seeing that people just have not put the money in the UK to receive primitive legal advice, we've done it for the National Health Service and it works really well. NHS is really interesting because the NHS has got the National Health Service in England has got a website and also a call centre. And I think the experience, if the stats aren't exactly right, but it's something remarkable, like 25 million people have used the call centre. Since the website came on, still the same amount of people using the call centre, but many, many more millions of people consulting online. It's what I call the latent market. And so when you speak to that private equity people, they are just open to all sorts. There's an openness that you want. So if you sat down with external investors, they'd be going, oh, that's interesting. Whereas if you speak to most lawyers, they'll say, I'll tell you what, that wouldn't work in my business. That different mindset. So
it's like trying to persuade fancy chefs that McDonald's is gonna actually take a big piece of the market.
Yeah. But it'd be interesting to compare the business Live Ops, which is doing very well here in the United States, to this model, which is, you can look it up, but it's a private equity. It's called Live Ops.
Live Ops.
And it's been invested in by private equity guys here, actually, sort of later stage venture capital, and they're just minting money. It's a very simple idea, but they provide that sort of services where they do it using people all around the country in industries that haven't usually used call centers, and they have a bunch of people who are the primary skill base has been moms who are at home who have been very, you know, in business, but now are have a couple hours here and there. And you can imagine the same with contract lawyers, right? The moms who have been lawyers in big firms who then spend a few hours, you know, as the call center lawyer, using the LiveOps model, but doing these relatively commoditized legal services.
Yeah.
And infrastructure for these big companies has now been built up.
If the Obama campaign can use 1 hour of your time and 15 minutes of your time to call people all over the country and arrange for taxi cabs to take them to the polls, then a call center could arrange that kind of thing.
You raise a just go up on a tangent for a second, but I was at a fascinating seminar yesterday where Professor David Wilkins was taking some graduate students, and it was about the other chap who was there, just coincidentally we're both here at the same time, the chap who set up a company called Axiom. I don't know if you know about Axiom, but Axiom's really interesting. It's the way I describe it, I don't think he enjoyed, but it's essentially leasing lawyers. So this is the challenge that many in-house legal departments need. They roll along fairly steady, work, and they have a spike. It might be a big deal, it might be a big dispute, it might be a big administrative job, and they need help, external help. Bringing in external law firms, X hundred dollars an hour, doesn't prohibit it. What they essentially do is provide, they've got a pool of lawyers. It's a bit like, again, he didn't like the phrase temp agency, but it's a bit like having, he's got several hundred lawyers are available, and they go in at half the price. Now, the lawyers do this because they've made a lifestyle choice. They're not working. They may or may not be available, and it is many mothers at home, and it's actually galvanized a whole bundle of lawyers that otherwise wouldn't be used in the community. So again, the private equity mentality, when they hear this, oh, that's a different
excess capacity
that's
right.
Different philosophy.
Cloud law and another.
I spend my life trying to convince conservative lawyers that there's new and different ways of doing things. You've got a tall order with a project like this, because it challenges their way of thinking.
I think part of the opportunity is these community-based organizations that and this is the interesting notion of private law, the extent to which people can be governed by their own private laws, and so you're sort of getting away from being dependent upon your traditional legal infrastructure, the extent that you can.
And some of your reputation stuff would tie into this. Very, very, very interesting.
Absolutely.
We are getting to a stage where my support folks are waving and saying we're getting to that stage where we have some food available. This is not the only portion of this conversation, luckily, that we will have. I appreciate the folks who have joined in the morning part, which was really around some of these specific tasks. I think just about everybody here is going to be able to stick through the afternoon, and the afternoon is where we're going to open it up a little more broadly to say, not only are we looking at what the tasks are, but then what does that mean for our curriculum, what does that mean for law schools, what does that mean for training at the practitioner level, where do we take that out. But I think we'll recapitulate some of the themes we've hit here. Also, we got some chance to talk, we'll have some chances to talk individually. Before, though, we go to lunch, we have only tangentially hit evolvable law. We have come back and forth on that a bit.
Right.
Okay. Next steps is the next meeting, perhaps. But at least my feeling, again, one of our goals here was to network build. I'm very glad to have had a chance to hear more from folks whose work I've seen or who I've met briefly before. Glad to have more of that. I think from the Berkman standpoint, the Law Lab standpoint, we envision us as constructing an ongoing dialogue around these issues. And unless you opt out, right, you're in the network as far as we agree. And so we'll try and keep people in the dialogue. We'd also hope that you would keep us in the dialogue and think about ways that, as you think about next steps and resources, keep us in mind as place to come to and fro on this. Advancing digital institutional design. I picked up some things I need. We have other pieces of the goals that are we all right? Other things, next steps people want to put on the table. It's hard to stand between people and their lunch.
If it's okay, maybe we could continue the conversation over lunch. I think we have to leave for resolve in about 15 minutes.
Okay.
I'm quite keen to
to test my slides. If I can be entirely
Richard, the two remaining events for the day are Richard's talk, Richard's formal talk, which is not in this building. It is over in Pound, is it? In
Griswold.
Okay. Griswold. It's over in Cape Griswold. That starts at 12:15, if I recall.
Yeah.
Formally, so we will need to be there shortly after 12.